I do wish that you could walk around these days and every poster you saw had a certain quality that these posters back in the late 60s had. I feel like in the late 60s here in the States, you know, most advertising design and poster design was really in a handsome, sharp mold, and everything just looked great. And I don't think everything looks great right now. You know, we're in all kinds of crises here in 2017, and one of them is, I think, our visual culture is kind of shot, but I think a lot of things are coming back. And I do think that there is a whole subculture now of people who appreciate design and appreciate poster art and collectible posters and prints by people like Mondo and things like that. So there's enough going around where there's still a great appreciation for great poster art. And I think it'll continue until we run out of ideas. And a lot has been done, but there's still more to explore, I think.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Coming up, we'll explore the handcrafted side of making movies with poster designer Sam Smith. But of course, the first lady of comic books finally makes her big screen debut this week. Does it live up to the hype?
What the hell is this thing?
The lasso of Hestia compels you to reveal the truth.
That is really hot.
We'll tell the truth about the long-anticipated superhero epic Wonder Woman. Plus, why London is welcoming its first ever architecture film festival.
A filmmaker wants to make a film. He has to have a good story. He has to have a plan. He has to show something that it needs to come out of his imagination, even an image, let's say.
That's all to come on this handcrafted edition of The Cinema Show on Monocle 24.
Why don't I meet you back at the office, and meanwhile I'll take this for safekeeping?
Oh, no, I don't think so.
You gotta put the sword down, Diana, please.
It doesn't go with the outfit.
At all. Put the sword down, first of all.
Promise me you will protect it with your life.
Yes. No.
It's been a long time between drinks for superwomen of the silver screen. Not since the epic failures of Catwoman in 2004 and Elektra in 2005 has anyone dared splash out on a big-budget female-driven blockbuster. Is Wonder Woman strong enough to break the curse?
You can trust her. Just hand that over.
Shield.
Just hand the shield to
there
her.
There we go. Whoa.
You got it? Thanks, Edda.
This is easy.
From Midori House in London, this is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Few films are forced to endure the kind of long gestation period that Wonder Woman has been through. A big screen adaptation was first pitched way back in 1996, long before the current climate of superhero saturation took hold. Wonder Woman has finally been unleashed on cinema screens this week, and the anticipation is higher than the heavens. Several actresses had been slated to take on the role of the First Lady of comic books at various times. There was an aborted project starring Jennifer Aniston, and of course the cancelled Justice League film that was to be directed by the man behind Mad Max Fury Road, George Miller. In that version, Megan Gale had been cast as the Amazonian princess. The long and troubled history might have been enough to frighten away some filmmakers, but not Patty Jenkins, who, despite having a favourable reputation in Hollywood, based largely upon just one film, told Warner Brothers that she was keen to wrap her lasso around the project any way she could.
From very early on, I had mentioned to Warner Brothers, I want to make Wonder Woman. Making a great superhero origin story was something I had always wanted to do, and Wonder Woman most of all, because I couldn't believe that nobody had made it, and because I believe in Wonder Woman, and because I believe in the origin story. So it was really it's a wonderful thing where it was not a fight to get the job and it wasn't a fluke to get the job. It was over such a long period of time that by the time I was doing the job, I had been thinking about it and talking to them about it for 10 years, you know? And so it was wonderful because all of that time, you know, I had different experiences, a lot of experiences working for studios on big budget pilots and really getting used to all kinds of different things. And so it was, it all came together with something I'd always wanted to do, finally.
Of course, it's not just the weight of the film's long production process weighing on Patty's shoulders. The character first appeared in comic books way back in 1941 and has been a staple of the superhero genre ever since.
I mean, I am a huge Wonder Woman fan myself, so no one cared more than I did that that be lived up to. And so it was not something I took lightly, and none of us did. Like, I was very serious about, like, trying to make the most out of this opportunity for Wonder Woman and for the world.
The result is a wonderfully crafted, visually spectacular adventure story. Early scenes on the island of Themyscira evoke the beauty of a Mediterranean paradise, and Matthew Jensen's cinematography captures it all perfectly. The story pays great tribute to its comic book origins. The mythology of Wonder Woman has always been just a little bit silly, and wisely, the film isn't afraid to poke some fun at itself while remaining loyal to the rich history of the character.
What the hell is this thing?
The lasso of Hestia compels you to reveal the truth.
But it's really hot.
What is your mission?
Whoever you are, you are in more danger than you think.
What is your mission?
I am a spy! I'm a spy.
Superhero stories are at their best when they're brave enough to embrace the full absurdity of science fiction and fantasy, while keeping their roots firmly planted in worthwhile, socially conscious stories. Zack Snyder's Man of Steel and Batman vs. Superman tripped over themselves by favouring special effects and noise over character and story. Mercifully, Patty Jenkins has avoided such a fate. Wonder Woman, both the film and the character, as played by Gal Gadot, is smart, ferocious, flawed, and perhaps most importantly, she stands for something bigger than us. As we follow her journey from Themyscira to wartime London, we're asked to consider the concept of war from the perspective of someone who thinks such battles are only fought by ancient gods. DC's efforts at building a blockbuster movie universe have been plagued by a dreary preoccupation with darkness and grittiness. Within its first few minutes, Wonder Woman shakes off all of that, establishing its own brand of mythology, more akin to the charming, classic truth and justice world inhabited by the original 1978 version of Superman. Wonder Woman isn't struggling to find a place for herself in a strange new world, nor is she weighed down by a struggle with inner turmoil. She's an action hero, a strong, independent woman in a man's world. No wonder they call it a never-ending battle. Wonder Woman is out in theaters just about everywhere right now. Don't be fooled by previous lackluster superhero efforts. This one is an exception, and it really should be seen on the big screen. Still to come, our handcrafted special takes off with poster designer Sam Smith. But first, let's take a look at this week's box office report. Despite some fairly ho-hum reviews, Disney's latest installment of the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise tops this week's list, taking in more than $60 million in the US so far. Disney also makes second place thanks to its Marvel Universe. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 has raked in just over $21 million. And at third place, there's Baywatch, Paramount's big-screen adaptation of the 90s television series. It suffered a walloping by critics upon its release last week. Its $18.5 million taking will no doubt be raising some hopes over at Paramount that the film might yet sail through its stormy opening. There was a time not so long ago when handcrafted posters played a vital role in a film's advertising strategy. Even throughout the 1980s, films such as Teen Wolf, Jaws, and Fright Night gave multiplex popcorn fare a certain hand-drawn quality. While the poster for the new Guardians of the Galaxy film fondly revives the handcrafted era, the art form is generally less popular today. But if the poster designer, Sam Smith, had his way, we'd be in for a revival. His redesigns of posters for films including Vertigo and Rosemary's Baby have helped introduce the films to new generations. Here, he explains how he reinterprets well-known classics into something fresh.
Oftentimes, I get a brief from my client, and a great client will have a good idea about what they'd like to showcase about the film, the star, or its themes, but they leave a lot of room for me to interpret how I want and visually interpret those themes. And so I dive right into the film and watch the film. I love to experience the other films of the director and reacquaint myself with their world and their vision and listen to the soundtracks. I often work with the soundtracks for the films. I'm a soundtrack geek. So I'm just immersing myself in that world. And then as I watch the film again, keeping in mind the brief, also just kind of jotting down all the themes, images, and things that come to mind, things that could be visually interesting to turn into a poster. By the end of the film, you have your sketchbook and you have a whole kind of bank of ideas, images, concepts, and then you kind of just see what floats to the top.
Lei ha mai parlato di me?
Poche volte, ma sempre con tenerezza.
Like in La Ventura, we want to use Monica Vitti for sure. We know that going in. And then you kind of juxtapose her image with some of the themes. You create a design that comes about from the themes, and you let the concept determine the execution. I try to let the concept determine if I want to illustrate or use photography or make something really abstract and crazy looking or something very beautiful and lovely and having a certain mood or tone. And so you kind of let the concept of the poster determine how it will look.
I hope we will too.
What?
Meet again sometime.
Yeah. Fine.
Vertigo was such an... It's probably the most iconic poster of all time, I would say, by Saul Bass. I really loved the chance to rebrand a movie that has such a famous poster because you get to go in a totally different direction. And with this one, you know, in the Saul Bass, you have the man, the protagonist, falling through the spiral. But really, the film is about, it's as much about the women as it is the man. And I wanted to kind of play with the duality of the two female characters, who are both played by Kim Novak. You don't see that in a lot of the posters that have been done for the film back in the day. So I thought that would be really a easy, fun thing to play with, to also create kind of a vortex in which the two identities of the women are kind of like morphing together. There's a great promo still of Kim Novak from the film that Hitchcock put out. And I used that and another still from the film and just created this kind of reduced graphic design where I didn't have to do a lot of detail work. It was just the simple iconic silhouettes of the women and a kind of vortex of heads. For the text there, I always like the chance to do something interesting with the title treatment and the lettering. And in this case, you have the classic poster has Saul Bass's famous hand-cut lettering. But for this, I took the actual typography from the title sequence, which hadn't been used much in other posters. That's my little nod to the actual film design.
Trying to get me to be his mother.
Aren't you his mother?
For Rosemary's Baby, I was asked by Criterion to try out some designs for the new edition. However, the original poster, which was done by Stephen Frankfurt's big advertising company back in the day, it is another one of the most iconic, famous posters of all time, and I think one of the best posters ever designed. So that was looming very large. However, I wanted to explore some things. And in this case, the brief was just try anything you want. We're not going for something necessarily creepy. We want something, you know, interesting and beautiful that conveys some of the themes. And so I just tried all sorts of things because we were really throwing everything at the wall to see what would stick and see if we could come up with a fresh approach other than using the original poster. So I did a couple kind of actually Saul Bass influence kind of reduced very iconic illustrations that are just kind of fun. One's black and yellow and white, and it kind of has Rosemary encountering kind of like her shadow, because the film is a lot about in her mind, her fears about who she is as a woman and what's happening in her life. the darker shadow side of herself, I guess. Another photographic treatment, to do something very different, I photographed my girlfriend and her necklace that we actually got in Croatia, which is a similar necklace to the one you have in the film. And I thought that the necklace that you see in the film would be an interesting image to use for the poster, a symbol, you know. And so I photographed her, just made a very simple black and white photograph, high contrast, and then put a pink color over it just to make it something beautiful. And I also, in this case, used the typography from the title sequence, once again, just like in Vertigo, because in the original poster, you have that nice sans serif, very clean, modern type treatment, which is brilliant. But in this one, I wanted to use that more script-like typography from the title sequence.
C'est celui qui a fait le western avec Marlene Dietrich qu'on a vu vendredi soir.
Ah oui, c'est formidable.
Moi, j'aime M.
Le maudit?
Oui.
On l'a vu l'autre jour à la télévision.
This is one of the first pieces I ever did for a film, the poster for Contempt, Godard, and I was very influenced by Cuban posters. I was touring as a musician. I always did art as a child and as a teenager and did poster art. Then I studied film in college, film studies at NYU, and only years later did I have the idea to combine my love for making poster art with my love for film. And so I had found a book of Cuban revolutionary posters and film posters, and it's such an amazing period of design, and I was so inspired by these. And so I decided to sit down, it took about a week, and just made a bunch of little designs very fast for films that happened to be showing at the Belcourt Theater, which is our local beloved art house here in Nashville. And I just wanted to crank out some little designs that were very graphic and simple, based on whatever they were showing at the time, and then to pitch to them the idea of doing some prints for special occasions. That's what got me started in doing all of this. So this is one of the posters I made during that week. Just a very simple solution graphically. You have Bardot, you have, in this case, showcasing Godard and Bardot as kind of the stars and the main headliners of this film. And so have their names really large and have it be mainly typographic, but also have a kind of stunning, iconic image of Bardot there in the bottom. And then just have red and gold. I didn't really think this through much. I just made it because I thought it would look cool. A lot of my very first posters were like that. And I often nowadays wish I could get back to just a simple design like that that I don't think about so much. So yeah, that's one of my favorites as well.
Designer and illustrator Sam Smith. And you can hear more about Sam's world of movie artwork by listening to his very own Poster Boys podcast. Up next, we'll find out why it's time London welcomed its very first architecture film festival. Stay tuned. The streets of Mubi are a little darker this week, and everything has turned a bleak tone of black and white. That's because a special film noir retrospective has taken over, starting with the 1946 classic Gilda.
So this is Johnny Farrell. I've heard a lot about you, Johnny Farrell.
Really? No, I haven't heard a word about you.
There's also the superb 1953 tense thriller The Hitchhiker by pioneering female director Ida Lupino. And from one of the great auteurs, Jacques Tourneur, 1957's Nightfall, a haunting psychological masterpiece. Sample a whole month of movies for free right now. Head over to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. We might think we know about the various facets of designing a film, the construction of a set or designing the props and the furniture, but the role of architecture is perhaps somewhat less explored. Architecture on the screen is, of course, quite different to the profession itself. Fictional buildings generally don't actually exist, but the idea is to make us believe that they do, and that is where the magic happens. London's first ARC Film Fest lights up on Tuesday, the 6th of June. Founders Charlotte Skeen-Catling and Manuel Toledo Otagi explain the subtle links between architecture as an artistic profession and the creation of fictional cinematic worlds.
It was a great big white elephant of a place. The kind of crazy...
Come along, fella, you're going with us to the Bat's Cave.
Where's Kansas?
That's where I live, and I want to get back there so badly I don't want to...
There are so many links between architecture and film, and they go far beyond just the context in which films are set. It's funny, the first thing that anyone ever asks is, when we talk about a film festival, an architectural film festival, is what is an architectural film? We are trying to open that question up in the festival itself and define it, you know, in many different ways. So at the very basic level, it could be a film about architecture, it could be a film about architects, it could be a film by architects, it could be a film where architecture plays a very central role. For instance, Blade Runner or Inception or Clockwork Orange, any of the Hitchcock films, some of the silent films. It could be an art piece where architectural elements are being manipulated. We have a piece by Martha Fiennes that uses algorithms to morph architecture into different shapes, which she does with actors. We're looking also at work by Iconem and Factum Arte, where they're using drones to scan places in conflict zones where architecture is under attack, and they're using that to reconstruct sites of cultural heritage and importance. My name is Charlotte Skeen-Catling, and I'm a co-director of the festival, but I'm an architect and have a practice in architecture and a strong interest in film.
I found a very good example. One very early film from George Lucas is called THX 1138, where he represents a prison where there's no limits, so all spaces are wide and endless. You could say, well, he tried to deny the fact there is a built space, but by doing that, you also reinforce the idea that you are in an architectural space. So you see, even though you could try to avoid having any relation with architecture, filmmaking is architecturally bound. You cannot run away from it.
My name is Manuel Toledo. I'm also co-director of the festival. I am industrial designer by trade, which took me to study public spaces that rely on architecture, film, and so on and so on. So I also produced an architectural film festival in Santiago in Chile, so that was somehow the link coming up, mm-hmm. up to London. A filmmaker wants to make a film. He has to have a good story. He has to have a plan. He has to show something that it needs to come out of his imagination, even an image, let's say. Well, an architect, when he comes for a project, it does exactly the same. Has to have a plot, has to have the business arranged and the images to sell what he's actually trying to achieve with it. So they are actually very much attached to each other in this sense. And today with technology, even closer, because designers and filmmakers are using the same software and probably making the same business pitch because, yeah, they are selling exactly the same thing, something that does not exist, and they have to make it and make it happen.
We're moving in the festival through a curatorial idea of scale so that you start at the scale of a room so that you've got, for instance, Louis Malle's Lift the Scaffold, where the whole plot revolves around someone being trapped in a lift. You've got another film, The Room, where everything is, you know, focused in this tiny space. Then you move to a larger scale, the scale of a building, you know, the watching buildings, you know, Rear Window, where you've got the Hitchcock focus on the back plot. And you're literally seeing these filmic lives play out through the different windows of the neighbours. And that leads a sort of edited forms of life that become the suspense and the plot. Then you move to a tower block. So you've got Lion, you've got Clockwork Orange, you've got Gomorrah, I think we're showing up, maybe. You know, all these different things where suddenly you're at the scale of an estate in a small societal group. And then you can move up a scale to Kwanaskutsi, you know, to 2001. So you're moving through scales.
Here in this fortress of solitude, we shall try to find the answers together. So, my son, speak.
Charlotte Skeen-Catling and Manuel Toledo Atagi. ARC Film Fest is part of the London Architecture Festival. Head over to arcfilmfest.uk for details. That's all for this week's show. Next week, we're launching our very first spin-off series, Action. We'll step behind the curtain and meet the makers behind the cinema experience, starting off with the designers of the title sequence in Steven Spielberg's Catch Me If You Can.
Today, I don't know so much about title sequences. Certainly, at that time, the title sequence was a piece of art before the film and was the moment for the designer to express his vision of the film.
Today's show was edited and mixed by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolin Goffan. The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Ryland. We'll catch you then.